This is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, so this is from a lecture on a new book that has come out called The George Floyd Uprising, edited by the Vortex Group. I'm just going to read you, and this features Idris Robinson and others who shall remain nameless. So let me just read you the back of the book jacket. In the summer of 2020, America experienced one of the biggest uprisings in half a century. After George Floyd's murder at the hands of Minneapolis police, angry crowds took to the streets night after night, fighting the police, looting, and eventually burning down the Third Precinct. The revolt soon spread to cities large and small across the country, where rioters set police cars on fire, sacked luxury shopping districts, and forced the president into hiding in a bunker beneath the White House. Throughout the summer and into the fall, localized rebellions continued to erupt in Atlanta, Chicago, Kenosha, Louisville, Philadelphia, and elsewhere. Written during the riots, The George Floyd Uprising is a compendium of the most radical writing to come out of that long, hot summer. These incendiary dispatches from those on the front lines of the struggle examine the new horizons opened by the revolt, as well as the social, tactical, and strategic obstacles it confronted. This practical, inspiring collection offers a toolbox for all those effectively seeking to expand and intensify revolts in the future, and it is essential reading for everyone interested in toppling the state, racism, and capitalism. And just one disclaimer, myself, my own opinion, if poverty is not violence, then certainly vandalism is not violence, and violence is something perpetrated on someone against their will. So, unfortunately, the FCC does not agree with me, so this station, we do not advocate the overthrow of the United States government. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. This is part two.
I mean, I have a number of things I want to talk about, but something that follows that. A thing that I think about a lot is the way in which we always talk about, like, prefigurative politics.
Yeah.
And about, like, building the future in the now.
Yeah.
Which, like, cool, yeah. Let's do it. We'll continue doing it.
Yeah.
But, like, it seems like it puts us in a positionality where we have the present, and then like, maybe this is part of the reason that, like DeBord's saying, like, we lose the past, is that we're looking at the present, we're looking at the future, we're like, no, we're trying to get from here to here, and that, like, part of the reason that spectacle is able to come in and rob us of the past, like, even, like, yesterday, is that we're not trying to build a yesterday. And so, like, I'm wondering if y'all have thoughts on, like, how do we build a revolutionary past in the present so that when tomorrow we haven't magically won overnight, that we actually have a past that is accessible to us, that is something that, like, we can pass on to future generations, but also to ourselves and each other.
I mean, I think for me, you know, what that speaks to is, I mean, honestly, this is something that I feel like I've learned a lot about from Latin American struggles, honestly, which is a much broader frame on, like, that cultural production isn't simply, like, something that you let staple on top, but becomes core to the whole meaning and action of the revolutionary world and activity. And so, you know, and I think that that's true in a lot of spaces. I think that one of the pitfalls, this is a theme I'm pitching the book here, is that we like, there's certain sort of like a very restricted lexicon or not even that, there's like a set of roles that we think of as radical roles, as revolutionary roles, and you know, it's like, you know, even I think there's something really admirable about, like, the Hong Kong model and, like, the light mages and all of that stuff. And I think that, you know, one of the benefits of that is it expands it more from just being, you know, like, you're either a radical in the streets, you're either black or you're nothing. I mean, it gave more ambit for different sorts of action. But I think that we need to expand it a lot further. And so that the work of carrying one generational struggle through to the next, it becomes core to the understanding of what it is that revolutionaries do, you know. And so I think that texts can help. Does anyone read anymore? Some of us.
All that shit.
But like, I think that finding the ways that memory works now and exploring them and getting really creative and honoring that and looking for the same thing that we look for in the tactical moments of the streets, looking for what gets that fire further, right? And what can be recuperated into the Black Studies classroom, which is, we can talk extensively about that whole move, right? Yeah. From the period of the 60s into the academy and what happened as a result of that. And we're still living the fruits of that, the damage. I mean, it's not that there were no victories there. There was a form of memory that happened there, but it was a certain sort of like a, what is it? It was a memory without, it was like a memory that was cut off here, right? And so what is that living memory? What is the memory that we make with each other when we're making dinner? What's the memory that we make with each other when we have children? And how does that carry generationally, you know? So I don't have all, I don't, you know, XYZ, but I do feel, you know, that, and you know, honestly, this is something that is better embodied in other parts of the world, probably, than the United States. And so it's one of many things that we have to learn from other places.
Thank you. I really appreciate you sharing that way. And I just to touch on a few points. One of the things that I heard you talk about there is one of the entry points, you know. And I really agree with that. And I think that sometimes. Okay, go ahead.
Can I finish my thought?
Please.
This is where I want to say I don't quote very well, but Rev Angel the other day, Rev Angel Keona Williams. She's like does somatics and yoga and stuff where she's revolutionizing and she's the first Black woman to be, you know, she's important.
Okay.
So she said the other day, the problem with the narrative of white privilege, right, is that it erases the fact of white supremacy, and that white supremacy narrative, even among our comrades, is that the majority of people who are in white bodies can't imagine what a fully liberated Black body is. And I can tell you what that is if you just listen, you know? And so, you know, thinking about how that is something that we don't hear about, I just kind of wonder, like, feels like often women, maybe it's because we don't operate from a print culture narrative as often, we busy, you know? Or don't have that, we're not elitist, we don't have access to, you know, ivory towers, are often, our narratives are erased until much later on, so we can talk about the history and who said what and who was this revolutionary leader as a woman 30 years ago, but were we listening to her when she was saying it? Did it matter?
Yeah. I'm with you. I think just to touch on a couple of things about this, what does it look like to have many points of entry, and to not get caught in some sort of holier than thou, more radical than thou, everything y'all doing is reformist kind of like self-separation. Like, what does it look like to do that in a way that also amplifies the fire in the belly and the commitment, that growing commitment to the death of this whole world, like, which is dangerous. That's
eat
the thing.
Together.
And eat together. Yeah. Right. Right. And so honestly, I just gotta say, for all of its limitations and you know, weaknesses, and even, you know, maybe overly cutesiness. Like, one of the things I kind of loved about the Portland scene was the efflorescence of blocks, the snack blocks. Like, you know, I mean, seriously, it was like a major feature of Portland scene. There was so much food. Like, you just go there to eat, like, cool snacks. And, right? I mean, you know, and a really valuable way. There was the witches, like, they're providing all this kind of, like, materiel, essentially. You know, but it was like in this way that was really about reproductive labor and about creating a doorway into like foregrounding, putting that right in the middle of the frontier gas. You know, Riot Ribs was this food-centric space that was like literally like clouds of gas, you know, with the gas mask flipping the ribs, you know? And, you know, like, and there's contradictions and there's challenges and there's all kinds of stuff. But there's something rich there, something that I think I would love for us to like take the next steps and the next steps and the next steps.
I think that like when we're talking about how like creating entryways, you know, for broad participation in our project, we should really start at this point of like, what are we bringing people into? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that really we just have to like, I guess like the way a lot of people imagine it, and I'm speaking particularly of like state communists and like socialist formations mm-hmm. and things like that, and even actually quite a few anarchist comrades think of it this way, is like, we have this communist project or this anarchist project, and we're going to try to like take it as it is and bring people into that or whatever. And it's just this very like rigid kind of sense of how to do politics, you know, that I guess like maybe, I don't know, I'm kind of going off there, but I think really we're gonna have success when we orient our efforts towards building like an ecstatic presence in the world. Something that like empire can't give us is like a life worth living, right? You know what I'm saying? People wake up every day depressed as hell. They hate their job. They just hate just hating on everything. You know what I'm saying? And you see it, like there's just so much violence in society, and it's because of this like rage that's being people are redirecting back at themselves. You know what I'm saying? There's just widespread misery, and like we need to be the antidote to that. You know what I'm saying? I certainly don't want to be miserable anymore. I'm done. Really, I'm done. I've had enough years of misery, feeling bad about things. You know what I'm saying? We're here to have a good time. We're living at the end of the world. We might as well keep it real out here. You know what I'm saying? So like, we need to just kind of lean into that. All right? We want to give ourselves a good life as well, and we want our efforts to be like that.
Yeah, this kind of connects to both like the idea of like having multiple fronts and also like talking about like the past as now. And I think it's just kind of like, it's not all like, yes, the riots are a very important thing, but it's also like, you don't step in and out of like being an activist when you go to that and then come back. It's like, this is something, like even the term like activist, as opposed to like just being a person who wants this for the world and people they love. And like, we all have this hate and contempt for that, but the reason we have that is because we have this love for people around us, and we want to see us and them have a better life. And so I think that just kind of sense of like, I don't know, there's a lot of tension and fighting between like, what should we be doing? What's the right thing to do? As opposed to like, are we doing something to like further what we care about and what people around us care about and like, take care of each other? And because like I just remember back to like I really love intersectional history, and a lot of like stuff that's not talked about as far as like the civil rights movement is the groups of like people who were kind of like non-violent activists and people who are willing to be violent, protecting them, make sure that while they're trying to do what they're doing, they didn't get killed. And so the sense of like community between people who are fighting for these things in this way and fighting for these things in this way and protecting each other, and just kind of this, I don't know, like kind of what, like what we were talking about there, like having these multiple fronts of like it coming from a sense of what you really believe in as a person and how you can create that in your life in multiple different ways, as long like as well as other people and their own ways, as long as you're fighting for the same thing.
Just like kind of jumping in on all these things, I think that one of the things that I think about in terms of this is that like, I mean, like, War and Peace was a long book, but, like, I'm not a Tolstoy anarchist. Like, I'm not fighting for the kingdom of heaven. I want the world to get weirder. Like, I don't think that there's a solution and there's a way to have community. I'm like, let's do a bunch of them, and I want to spend the rest of my life, like, jumping around between them and being, like, weird is cool, and I get to try different shit. Mm-hmm. And so there's maybe a thing that we could speak to in terms of, like, I don't think that we're going to achieve a weird world unless we have like a weird and revolutionary movement. We've got to have like lots of different ways in which like things are happening. So like multiple entry points is maybe like getting away from the idea of like, this is the effective tactic or this is the thing, And like it's important to like look at how other people are organizing and do this. And I'm definitely not making like a left unity given because like that I want a very disunited left, but I want a disunited left that is able to work together, that is able to come into like the riot space and be like, cool, but like let's go at the state right now. Where it becomes sort of a like, and I think that this is maybe like a way in which we can be like, how do we open up multiple entry points? And it's like you're already here, you're already in here. Like you don't have to be doing a thing. Just like, is it in your belly? Like it, and it's not like, have you achieved the status? Have you done enough? And it's not, and it also counters that like liberal co-optation where like. It's like, well, if you're not doing, like, no, it's actually bad that you're this mad about it. Like, you're, like, it is racist that you were this angry about this.
We know why I'm mad. You know what I mean? We know why those people are mad.
And it's like, yeah, like, what, you know,
it's obvious to
everyone. Multiplicities or plurality, or we could go into, like, blues and everything, but, like, let's not. I think that, you know, like, unity of means and ends, basic and 101, like, anarchist, like we, the way that we create a weird world is by having a really weird revolution, and the way that we create a weird revolution is by, like, being weird and by appreciating the weirdness of the people, that it's like, hey, like, this is what I have to contribute, and, like, not being, like, how does this work into my revolutionary project? But accepting that it's like, hey, like you also have that in your belly. You're doing this from your belly. Even if I don't understand it, even if it's not legible to me, the point is not for all of us to be legible to each other. It's for all of us to like be expressing that anger simultaneously in such a way where like we don't have to understand each other to be able to simultaneously move against the state. And maybe we can only overthrow the state by accepting the fact that we are going to have to operate in spaces where we don't understand everybody.
There are people who are just straight up out there who are better comrades to us than most self-identified radicals are.
Right.
I mean, honestly, those people are really the ones we gotta be catching up to. You see the way the trolls threw down? They routed the police in every city in the country. A couple years ago, why should we be trying to like, let's bring everybody in anarchism now? Like, no, that's backwards. Like, let's move in this direction. You know what I'm saying? Like, nobody wants to experience what they experienced in summer 2020 and then come into the anarchist milieu. That's a great example of why nobody wants to join us.
One of my favorite local anti-fascists is a 55-year-old white guy who is annoying as hell. He's the most annoying person, but when he saw Nazis, fascists, cops picking on, he said, little girls. You know, he started punching fascists.
So, you know, tangling, good idea. Set up a zine table, I swear to God. Set up a zine table wherever you want. And just start giving stuff out to people, you know what I mean? But we gotta start connecting with people like, I don't know, you know, as a self-identified anarchist, that's what I try to do. Just like, really just trying to generalize the idea of giving people the information out there and try to connect it as broad of a base as possible. Because I swear, I've been like tabling sometimes, and there's people you wouldn't expect. People, like old people come up to the table and they'll take like zines like Cars Riots, Black Liberation, stuff like that, and they get excited about it. And I would say more people than not get really excited. It shows that there's like widespread support for these ideas, so we shouldn't trick ourselves into thinking that there's not a broad base of support for insurrection.
Yeah,
there is.
I wanted to say, I feel like exactly what we're talking about here is the strength that we're seeing in the Atlanta movement to defend the forest. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is where you see children with their parents and teachers marching in the streets. It's where you see people in black blocks breaking windows at the same time. Where you see like old people coming together to talk about what does it mean for them to be against Pop City and to defend the forest. Going to the forest, being outside of the forest in the city, all of these people coming from their different sort of like subjectivities or whatever to come together in this movement. I think it's like really important to think about why that is. I encourage people to like read some of the texts from Atlanta that are coming out. I think they're really informative. I think
continuity has like a big role to play in like the strength of that movement. It's like people continuing to be together over like many years, over many months, every day, sort of like holding each other, yeah, in this space where it's like you come from a reality and you are doing something, and although it's not what I want to do, I don't want to go to the courthouse to present this piece of legislation or whatever, but I support you in you doing that. And sort of like everyone accepting each other in their modes. I think it's cool. I just want to bring it up in that context.
Okay. For real.
Yeah, and just I guess to say, also there's this piece here of this experimentation about what does it actually look like for this, because like we're familiar with the sort of liberal, like any interaction with liberals meaning that we lose, right? Or the sense of like if it gets drawn into some electoral process, then we're just going to get drawn down, and it's going to be good protest or bad protest, and we're. But Atlanta is an example, and it's not the only one, but it's the one that's right now, you know, is really vital of we're the contagious ones. Like this fire can spread into those courtrooms, into those people that are, you know, like writing letters, into those people that are walking with their kids down the street, rather than this sense of that if we're not pure, then we're going to kind of like be dissolved into by this like. And that's again the damage of wokeness, is this sense of everybody trying to be more. If you're not pure, 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 if you're not pushing away everything that's even slightly not perfect, then you're running the risk of being the next person, you know, denounced. And like, that's the opposite of what we're seeing. Like, we have to be the contagious ones. We're.
I guess this kind of goes along with your weird thing, but. You mentioned that it started as a joke, and I wondered if you speak or maybe even Fred could speak about the connection between joke and theory, and like just like that. The does some theory come out of just jokes?
Ford would say something about that, right?
What's that?
Ford would say something about that. Well, you know, it was like. The honest answer is this, right? Is like, you know, with that, like, oftentimes, like, and this is just very personal, right? Like, I think when, well, at least in my experience being in the movement, right? Like, you go to the go-to thing, right? Like, okay, we're gonna do this, like, I don't know, we're gonna serve food, or we're gonna do this talk, right? And like, in my head, it just never works like that. I'm like, we're gonna do this and this is gonna blow up, and like there's gonna be fire, and like it doesn't typically, then like I'm sad for like 2 years, like I don't know why I didn't blow up, but that one I was like, we're gonna go to the Chaz, we're gonna do a talk, we're gonna march out, we're gonna burn down Seattle, and it didn't really work like that, but you know, it got lit, you know what I mean? So it was pretty live, and you know, you know, I wrote that text on pain, I don't know if you like, and like, it was saying like, you know, like I don't really see the need to do anything, like unless it's gonna be a riot, you know what I mean? And you know, I mean, this is just my personal like feelings, right? And that like I don't really see much in the world that's worth anything except ripping it apart, right? So, and that was the same kind of impetus, right? Like let's do this, if we're gonna do something, we're gonna do it for real, mm-hmm. You know? And. So, half joke, right, you know, but, like, I guess Marcus used to say, like, radicals shouldn't take themselves, revolution shouldn't take themselves so serious, right? They really shouldn't, right, you know, and you take other people serious, right, and their well-being and their health and their and your love for them, right, but everyone in this country takes themselves so serious, right? It's weird, right? We're the biggest jokes in the world, right? Yeah. I don't know.
I like jokes.
No.
I love humor. I think humor is such a good. I feel like it's terrain which like our enemy has trouble operating on, or like, you know, just a lot of people, like, you can't like force yourself to be funny or force yourself to be humorous, you know, like.
good example of that is like Elon Musk, this guy motivated. I feel for real. I feel like he's most motivated by the fact that he just doesn't know. He wants to be a poster so bad, but he doesn't know how to tweet, and he's like getting really mad at. He's getting really mad at like these developers. Like, why isn't anybody seeing my tweets or whatever? But really, it's just this like he's just not funny. You know what I'm saying? Like, he has a lot of money, but he just can't buy it. Sense of humor, so I think it's important. I want to say that kind of going along with like what I was talking about earlier, like the, you know, like the pros are doing crazy constantly, like stuff that would be if anarchists were doing it in an organized way or like a revolutionary movement was doing it in an organized way, we would be like, damn, these people are serious about it, you know. So like we kind of have this joke, we call it distroism. Okay. And it's like pointing out like chaotic things that happen in the news all the time, like you know, like people, like six people will run like some, okay, so right, you have like anarchists, so like revolutionary people posting memes all the time about like shoplifting, and if you see somebody stealing, no, you didn't steal something from work day or whatever, but then you got like 10 people that hit your local news and these people stole $21 million in some retail bus ring. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, who's really the one that we want to be hearing about shoplifting from? These people on Twitter, or is it, you know what I mean? Like, kind of who's, like, I guess just reframing the thing, like, there's these practices all over the place that are kind of, that are like, I mean, they're criminal for sure, but we want to kind of think of it as like these people are actively like subverting, you know, subverting things, and there's like maybe connections or lessons that can be learned from those types of things. So yeah, it's just like this term has just been assigned to kind of like things like that, that kind of point to maybe these practices, and then also like it's humorous because it sometimes points to things that are widespread practices that are chaotic, but like are not necessarily revolutionary, just to kind of be confusing about it. But,
yeah, thank you for bringing up distroism, because I think that's really important, especially like in the kind of cycle of struggle that we've been in the past like 10 or 20 years that like take place mostly in the sphere of like circulation of commodities, you know, not so much at the point of production, like you blocking roads, you know, highways, trains, you know, this is all important because one of the main, one of the biggest distroist activities is wrong way driving, which is also, I think we should see as a circulation struggle.
What the fuck? You just really go on the other side of the road and be like, but it's like to be like, I don't care, I'm like, this makes me go faster, right? That's what you're talking about.
It's not original to distroism, though. It's actually, it was like to go on driving with the flow of the traffic is madness. The wrong way driver is not coming, it's here. We're already reversing the wrong way up the highway on ramp of revolution.
Oh.
So it's not original.
The Oscar Mayer Wiener had his catalytic converter still.
Oh, wow.
Here we go,
Yeah,
sure. Because the Oscar Mayer Wiener is like an essential part of white identity. We never talk about the Oscar Mayer Wiener, and all of a sudden, all the white people know about this big ass burger. They never served me out in Austin.
Yeah, I mean, look, like the level of illegality in America now is like through the roof, right? And it's been a month. I mean, I'm like in New York, it was like we were afraid of the cops for since Giuliani took office, right? And now it's lit. You know? Yeah, and it's like how it used to be when I was a kid, you know, like where, you know, people are drinking in the street, people are partying. I mean, like, this one guy almost got caught drinking in the street with a huge bag of drugs, right? And it was like, it would have ended, you know, but now you could just roll around with a huge bag of drugs and drink in the street, you know?
This is a victory that...
Yeah, one more victory for the social war. That was our old joke, right? You
know,
yeah.
If, I don't know if anybody hasn't heard about it yet, but the Lane County's DA office has said that they are so short-staffed and all of their staff is so under-trained and they have so many cases piled up that they are not prosecuting misdemeanors. Just like theft under 1,000 is legal.
And the only way to keep that going is to commit misdemeanor.
This was a coordinated effort for a lot of assistant DAs to quit at the same time.
Wow. Okay, crazy.
They were doing their thing.
Nice.
But on the flip side, like just to be the downer, right?
you know, like it's cool to steal stuff, but like we gotta like take down a whole damn city, right? Let's just not forget about that too, right? Or like, you know, and detach it from everything and be like this, or burn a whole damn city and leave it to the ashes, right? So let's we gotta think big too, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I actually heard something earlier today on this note that I first thought was a joke upon hearing it, and then I really sat with it and considered it, and I came to agree with it. But a friend said the uprising was ultra positive and not destructive enough.
Yeah, for sure. It was hell and not destructive enough.
Yeah.
We could do way better than that.
Totally. The not destructive enough part, that was like obvious.
Yeah.
That was like, it's no problem.
Or not.
And then the positive part, I was like, that is such a joke. Like, what do you mean? And they were like, it's ultra positive in that it was for defunding the police, it was for abolitionists, for all of these like very positive, just like super clear like goals. But there wasn't like critical infrastructure attacked.
Right.
In many cities.
Yeah.
Some places
yeah.
there was. Mm-hmm. I think it's like an important thing to remember. I wonder if anyone else has
I think that happening was a really interesting development. That happened in South Africa a year later. There was a really crazy insurrection and people went after infrastructure like all over the entire country, and that was, you know, a year after the war rebellion. And so it felt like an image from the next step, right?
All right.
Good.
Hey, Matt. I think as we grew larger, you're the man was the next movement is about our manlessness. You know, we had a whole space in Seattle with Chaz, right?
Yeah.
Holding space is important.
Yeah.
Having space.
Mm-hmm.
One of our biggest struggles is just having a place to live. Like, you don't have to be bored, but I need food, shelter, and water. How do you need clothes if I have those kind of things? And those are things that we're paying for. And largely, in large part, most of us are losing our grip on being able to continue to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's next.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, or it's now.
Yeah.
You really can feel that or it's not yourself.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. I guess beyond, like, to get in, you know, like, beyond the territory and the geography, it's like the word that's bigger than that for me is relationship. So it's like capital intervenes and denies us the ability or like tries to control all of our relationships, right? Like relationship to place, relationship to food, to the land, to the earth. And that's, I mean, when I think about like what's at the basis of struggle, revolt, what is like essential to protect and to find, it's relationship. I think, like, where's the point of entry? It's like there is, the point of entry is just actually having a relationship. It's like defending it. And that's what, when we see people being charged with domestic terrorism, when we see people even just like getting non-association charges, like what they're really trying to do is destroy a relationship. Just relationship. That's what I think I want to defend and like want to create is like, that to each other, but like to the land, to
mm-hmm.
geography, to food, to everything that we are alienated from, right? That's like what we need to like get a hold of again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Atlanta feels powerful, because people all have a relationship to that place, and that's what they're trying to defend.
Mm-hmm.
I'll keep it brief, because I know it's getting late, but this is something I've been like debating with people and thinking with people about, let's see, how do we undermine any dependency that we have on the police force without recreating another police force, like having militias that actually do the community protection kind of stuff, but aren't becoming another police force? That seems to be like something that people ask a lot, and I just want to see more discourse on that.
Can I add with the question too of like also like not just police forces but like prisons and like a place for people to go / like a safe place for people to be, but like that's not just replicating a prison where like I just to add on to that, because like I've heard people who can criticize the human rights abuses inside of prisons, but like not the concept of prisons. So like I feel like that's like connected to police.
What about, just real quick, along with that, how do we recreate community defense in which the hierarchy of these people have guns and these people don't, regardless of what their politics or their stated politics or what they're involved in is, if these people have the guns and these people don't, how do you prevent that from reasserting itself as a power dynamic?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's a question of revolution, right?
Yeah.
And like, and to say like, and I don't think you guys, I want to hear what you guys have to say about it, but for me at least, like personally, you know, I think it'd be wrong for anyone to say they have the answers to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is a collective intelligence that comes from a revolt, right? Mass revolt, and that, you know, and that will settle, you know, what we do with the people who we need to punish and what we do, like, and how we protect ourselves, right? You know, and you know, there's no easy answers, and that's the good thing, right? Is that, you know, it's a radical unbinding of society and all of its prior institutions, so we don't know what's going to come after, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the wager, and that's the good thing, right? You know, so if anything, maybe it's not even it's not what we create, but what we make sure never comes back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that we know what it looks like, and we know what we don't want, right? You know, in the 19th century, it was a similar problem, right? They'd be like, when you read the old of the International Working Society, Person Society, right, or association, or like you read the documents that would come out of the first line of the working class movement, right? They'd be like, you know, to protect against counter-revolution, right? It would be literally like Germany sending its troops into the commune, right? But now it's everywhere, and we have to just stay on guard for that, right? It's not just the cops, right? It looks a lot different than an army, but. I don't have that one. I can't end those cops, right? Gracefully.
The burning of prisons is such a radical act and spectacle that it is transformative of everyone who witnesses it.
Yeah, for sure.
Hopefully, in such a way that the idea that it would reassert itself is inconceivable.
Like Adam said, right? When it comes out of the cage, when the prison door is open, the dragon comes out of the cage, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess just to say that I think this is actually one of the themes that is addressed pretty directly in various other texts. Rhythm and Ritual tries to address it very specifically in the context of Portland, because it was a situation in which, because of the duration, the question started to become a live one. You know, it wasn't something that we could just defer until after some event, and then it's something, everything's different, and suddenly we'll all know what to do. There were situations that had to be addressed, and were addressed in various ways, but not very successfully. And then I think that after that was written was the Red House experience, and I'm sure many of you know about or maybe were at. And I think that was the further iteration, which had further complexities. There was some real, I think, successes and experiments there that were useful, and there were also some real conflicts that were also useful. So I think it is a live conversation that we have some practice with, which I would encourage us all to try to remember as much as we can of, because it's not usually, we don't normally are in a situation where there are no cops and it is just us for an extended period of time. And then I guess the other thing I would say is just that there are also experiences all over the world in the past and also right now. There are many places in the world where there are no cops and people do navigate all kinds of ways. But I will say that I think that one of the elements to it, speaking of relationship, is that at the heart of the effective examples are modes of relationality and connection and coordination among people that allow for more than just the young folks with guns to have something like influence, to have a stake and a capacity to leverage that stake in assessing what's tolerable and what's going to be kind of immune systemed out and how. And then I think the other thing that's really true is that also those are overlapping each other. They multiple, in general, not always, but in general, multiple versions of those are in the same places. So we talk about a vision of a weird world, yes, and also that weirdness involves, you know, multiple like organized folks who are accountable to different ways of being that are going to be in some sort of uneasy or like organized or kind of all up in a mass. I mean, in a riotous kind of like confusion. It's gonna be all of those things. But I think this is not a purely imaginary thing to imagine into the future. There are lots of experiences, and also like in our own lives. You know, I mean, especially right now, I'm in fucking Portland. You call the cops, they don't come. So somehow or another, like, so let's be more conscious about that and intentional and creative.
Yeah.
I think what's important to think about too is like. For like maybe future versions of keeping the peace forever, it's like kind of how we think of like conflict, where I feel like a lot of people kind of come at this like we gotta make like community policing or community militias or community whatever, community self-defense, whatever they call it, many names, with the idea of like we're gonna deal with conflict the way that we deal with it in this world, which is like to defer it and suppress it.
Right.
And we have to instead, which is I feel like really this thing of like deferred conflict is something that really is very important to whiteness as well.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Passive aggressiveness.
And it's very comparable in Eugene. Yeah. And I'm gonna, yeah, so anyway.
Because they ship it overseas and drop bombs.
In the Northwest, it only happens after the fact.
What's up?
Policing only happens after the fact.
Yeah, so we want to think about that, but like,
that's very good.
Whereas, like, okay, we're going to have these conflicts. Like, if we break down, you know, we overrun the police and force the state out of here or whatever, and we're not getting bombs rained down on us, we somehow have, like, a moment to breathe or whatever, like, we're gonna have a lot of conflicts between us, and we want to use these conflicts as learning opportunities, you know what I mean? Rather than like try to run to put out the fires everywhere, we have to really deal with the, because right now we're not dealing with this broad range of conflicts that we're dealing with. That's the problem, we're not dealing with it. You know what I mean? So we're gonna have to deal with it. It's gonna be very scary. Damn, it's gonna be intense, but we're gonna get through it.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
You should call it when you come on. How you guys feel?
I raised my hand just the year before, not to say, but like just to sort of like, I wanted to like highlight the response that you did say, because like, I really, like, yeah, like, that is kind of like, the, like, whoa, like replacing, like, whatever, anyway, it's a big question, but I wanted to highlight just that, like, I really like what you said about finding collective consciousness in the movement and also knowing, like, what we don't want to replicate.
Mm-hmm.
And also reminding what you said of, like, knowing what we care about. That's why I raised my hand.
Look at Chiron. Chiron, Michoacan. Chiron, Michoacan, Mexico.
I do have one more that is was directly inspired by How It Might Should Be Done. So since you're here, I'd like to ask.
Yeah, of course.
So I was reading a different piece. I was reading a Graver piece. It's Beyond the Monastic Mind, I think. I think it was like a. It was posthumously published to Anarchist Library, where I was able to read it for free. But a lot of what he's sort of talking about is he's talking about the idea of like mind and self anarchistically. So it starts out with the idea of being like, oh, well, like, you know, if you're doing calculus, you can't do it in your head, you've got a paper and pencil, and like that could be considered like your mind at that point in time. It largely kind of gets into, it talks about some philosophical scientific movements, but like a lot of it is about like, oh, like co-writing. So like, you know, his Dawn of Everything, him and Wengro, like how that text could not have been produced by either of them. And like, I think of also like Monsieur Dupont, where like, it's fun to say in terrible French.
It's all good. I don't speak that shit either.
Yeah. But like the idea of like, you know, they talk about like nihilist communism, how they're like, we couldn't have done any of these things without like each other. The things that we produced were there. And when I was reading it, it immediately made me think of both Monsieur Dupont and also How It Might Should Be Done. And the reason that it made me think of it is like, so
These is two, while spearheaded by a black avant-garde, this largely multi-ethnic rebellion managed to spontaneously overcome codified racial divisions. The containment of the revolt aims at reinstating these rigid lines of separation and policing their boundaries. Mm. And so the reason that my mind just immediately went to there is I was thinking about like what is riot consciousness, mm-hmm. and how in that you were talking about how in riot, subjectivity is overcoming, like, whether we want to say, like, the subject is overcoming society, or, like, the self is overcoming, there's so many ways we can formulate it based off of, like, where you want to put, like, subject, self, like, materiality, like, but, my thought and the thing that I'm interested in, if any of y'all have thoughts on, is that I agree, but have not experienced the way in which so many of these terrible things fall away from subjectivity, from self, in the riot situation. But the idea of being like, oh no, you like Graeber being like, oh no, like the way that like co-creation is the creation of like another self almost, mm-hmm. where like there's the emergence of like, oh, there's a new self, and I was like, oh no, that's a riot. Like you're talking about writing, you're talking about like, well, you're talking about like doing calculus and how like the paper and pencil like forms your mind. But like I was just immediately, I was like, no, this is that's riot. Like being in riot is being in that extended where like I am no longer a self, and like it's not even just, so I guess that I'm saying like to expand upon that, it's not just that these things fall away, but that like would any of you have ideas on like the additive nature of riot consciousness?
I've heard that it's like seeing the world for the first time.
I've heard
it's like seeing the world for the first time. Maybe like you have a math problem in your head that you can't solve in your whole life, you're thinking about it, you know what I mean? And then you see the solution right in front of you, and it's like, I knew I was right. And I've heard that about those situations when the police are routed. There's really no cops.
But usually, like a lot, probably like the at least from on a personal level again, right? A lot of it comes from my experience in Greece, right? And that was a big part of writing the text, was that to some degree I had already gone through an insurrection, right, in 2008 in December. So that doing this one was like I was able to step back and just start writing, right? Whereas like if this was the first one, you couldn't have gotten me back inside to write anything, right? So I would have never left the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I did notice when I was in Greece was that there was just something about the way we related to each other then that it was like something I'd never seen before in my life, right? And I don't know if it's an additive thing, but you know, Greek people are very suggestive, right? Like this means what? Right, it's just the way it is, right? Or like, you know, the Italians do this, right? In South Italy, the Greek one is like this, right? But people were speaking with gesture constantly, right? And it was like way more than usual in Greece, right? And even we looted the supermarket, and I guess we've given up a lot already now, yeah. But we, like, you know, I just never tasted food that tasted that good, right? And it was really like, I mean, it was amazing. Right, and Greek food is good anyway, right?
Yes.
It's like you know, they have laws for organicness that like are like crazy, right? They're really like about like you can't have GMO food there, right? But it was insane how good the food tasted, right? Or like when we occupied the universities, like going in and hearing like the snoring, because we'd all sleep in the assembly, right? And it would be this like rhythmic snoring, just all these weird things that humans were like. We're reverberating off each other in a way that I never saw in my life, right? And that's kind of like where I was like, this is what it means to be human when I keep saying that. So I guess that, you know, there is points in everyday life where we grab that, right? But, you know, I really do want to focus on the fact that, you know, the last line of the text in the thing I just wrote on Situate Power, and it's a Benjamin quote, so I'm not going to end with a Benjamin quote, right? he says that, like, you know, divine violence is superior. Divine violence is superior to divine nonviolence. Only divine nonviolence is only superior to divine violence in the coming world. But in our world, divine violence is revolutionary violence, and it's always above, right? And I really want to hold on to the fact that, like, yeah, we might have glimpses of communality within our everyday lives here, but there's something to be said that's more significant in the uprising, right? And the real problem and the real difficulty for us that we have to figure out is how to make that uprising irreversible and make that our everyday lives, right? So,
good luck. All right.
Yeah.
My last question, like, your comments on weirdness reminded me of, like, perspective a little bit, and something that I thought of recently. It was actually in Spanish class on Valentine's Day. My Spanish teacher, I think, just kind of decided to, like, go rogue and, like, make us be friends more or something. I don't know. She just was, like, asked us these questions that were, like, about, like, how you are happy, like, with the world's struggles. And I don't know. They were kind of, like, special questions that were, like, meant for people to really reflect on in their heart. But I think just responding with what you just said, I want to add on an idea that there's not going to be a liberated future unless, like, there's not going to be one unless we, like, act like one now. And it seems to me like the thing that I said in Spanish class to how maybe you can be happy sometimes, even with struggles, is that, like, there is, like, sort of, like, this potential in every single moment. Like, you can try to appreciate a day for, like, the amount of moments that it has. It's continuous, the continuity of moments, and each moment sort of is having this, like, you can, like, find something in it to, like, change your perspective. And, like, that's something that sometimes just, like, makes a day special. Like, at the end of the day, that moment, like, just Spanish class, having that hour with people who I wouldn't have talked to. We didn't even really talk about it together, but everybody shared what they said, and it was, like, really, like, wow, like, people are really talking right now. And so, yeah, I think that, like, sort of, like, weirdness, it seems like people should just be able to, like, embrace whatever perspective they can bring, and, like, each person, like, obviously we all, like, know what we care about, but like, we only have our one little self, and we only are going to be going about, like, where we're at, like, somebody kind of was already saying this before, but, like, in each moment, like, what can we do to, like, build that, but I think it kind of went off of what you're saying, and it reminded me of what I kind of reminded me to say, with your weirdness thing, and the how it reminded me of, like, to, like, just kind of, like, and that's also just, like, pretty exuberant, too. It's kind of, like, liberating to be, like, whoa, like, literally, I could just, like, go, like, that way in this moment. And, like, it's kind of, like, sort of, like, a little bit of, like, a brain hack, too, I think, because, like, it could be, like, I don't know. Like, if you're running, you're super tired, and you can just, and, like, sort of just, like, I don't know, just sort of, like, deciding to disagree with that thought. Like, you kind of can have your own self, like, antagonism, I guess. That was a big way to say it, but, like, you know, like, yeah, just sort of, like, denying that thought and being like, no, like, I literally, like, I don't know. The way they said it was pretty cool. I can't really repeat it, but, like, I guess you remind me of that.
I mean, I will agree with meditation as a revolutionary skill, just in general.
It seems like this General Assembly has reached a consensus.
Yeah.
We're going to build an ecstatic presence in life. We're going to develop a very holistic approach to our organization.
This all star rocker on McDonald's. McDonald's is a place to rock. There's a restaurant where you buy food to eat. There's a good place to listen to music. keep it fucking in the back to rock music. Rock and roll McDonald's, rock and roll McDonald's, rock and roll McDonald's, rock and roll McDonald's. McDonald's will make you fat. They serve Big Macs, they serve quarter pounders. They'll put pounds on you. Rock and roll McDonald's, rock and roll McDonald's, rock and roll McDonald's, rock and roll McDonald's. Hamburgers are the worst. They are worse than Burger King. A Big Mac has 26 grams of fat. A quarter pound has 28 grams of fat. Rock and roll McDonald's. Rock and roll McDonald's. Rock and roll McDonald's. Rock and roll McDonald's. Rock over London. Rock on Bloomington, Indiana. Please, members and champions. Please, Mr. Vegas, the champion. Nice
kiss. Washington, D.C.